Ladies and gentlemen, Derek Hall.
Thank you, Kenny.
We're going to hit a lot of topics, or at least I'm going to try.
Oh, boy.
But we're going to start with my favorite story of the offseason, at least the favorite one that I wrote.
And you nailed it, too.
It was
I know where you're going.
5.5 hours that it took to sign Zach Greinke. Now, that is incredible to me still, and I'm sure it's incredible to most people. How did that come about?
Well, it was incredible to a lot. I think we shocked everybody. For about 2 weeks, Kendrick, our owner, he and I had been talking about the perfect solution for our rotation because, you know, looking at last year, and you guys know, but a top three offense and a top two defense, you know, our big glaring hole was starting pitching. So we knew we had to go into the offseason trying to acquire starting pitching, and our goal was to get two top of the rotation starters. And you know, we even visited a certain free agent who, you know, in the Dominican Republic, who signed with another team in the NL West. And so we were willing to spend. We had a new TV deal, which helped us, and we could see that we had revenues that had increased, and we could spend some money. But he and I were speaking for about 2 weeks. Every night, you know, I would text him about 7 or 8 o'clock at night and go, you know, the more I think about this, you know, the perfect person for us is Greinke. And he'd say, yeah, I know. And then he'd call me. What are we talking about this for again? And he'd say, I agree with you. He's great. And, you know, we had to face Greinke all these years when he was obviously with the Brewers and then the Dodgers. And he dominated us at Chase Field, which is not easy to do. And, you know, we just thought, this guy's perfect in our division with our needs. And then at the end of each phone call, we go, yeah, but it probably doesn't make sense. And we can't compete with the Dodgers and Giants. So it is now the Friday that we sign him, and the night before we had introduced our new jerseys and, you know, joined the Evolution and had a big party, and it was fun with all our players. So the next day on that Friday, I'm going to local ABC to have an interview. Hello, Nick. Have an interview and introduce our new uniforms. And I'm just about to walk in, and Ken calls me, and he says, do you have time to talk? I said, I'm about to do a live shot. Can I call you afterwards? He said, I think you better hurry. Why don't you, you know, call me before that when you get in the building. So I call him from the green room, and he said, are you sitting? And I said, no. And then he said, you better sit. And then he said, I've been thinking about it more, and I think we should pursue Greinke. And he said, I know he's real close to signing one of the two teams. You know, let's go get him. And we did. And, you know, it was intense negotiation, like you mentioned, for about 5.5 hours, because we didn't talk to him until about noon to Casey Close, his agent. And by 5:30, we had him signed. And, you know, at some point, talking about no one could believe it, you know, my wife is trying to find out if I'm going to go to my son's basketball game, you know, varsity basketball game on the west side of town, and she's calling me, and I'm hitting ignore, and she's texting me, and I'm ignoring her text. And then finally, I answer her at like 2:30, and, you know, I text her back, and I said, look, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm going. We're trying to sign Zach Greinke. And she wrote back, yeah, right. Are you going or not? So it was great, you know, but that first call to his agent, and, you know, and he's a wonderful guy. Casey's, you know, he's really good to deal with. And Casey said, look, Derek, he said, we're almost done. You know, I don't think you're in this. And I said, well, if we were to offer in the range of this, are we in it? And he said, let me call him. I'll be right back to you. And he talked to Zach, and Zach is such a smart guy, and he's such a student of the game. You know, it was probably 15 minutes later, Casey called me back and said, wow. He said, Zach sounded like a GM. He knew everything about your team. He talked about everyone on your roster. He talked about how your defensive shifts and how they worked last year and how if we bobble the ball, you guys are going to beat it out. He loved the way you played the game, and he's interested. So fortunately, we were able to do it.
Now, Derek, in this day and age, you know teams go through lengthy processes. They analyze decisions from every angle. Now, I know you were talking about it with Ken, but it doesn't sound like you guys did that here. It almost sounds like a spontaneous act. Is that a fair assessment?
No. You know, our analytics team had looked at all of the free agents. I mean, so obviously we had him. We had all the free agents ranked in order, and all the analytics were performed and video on everybody and how they pitched at Chase Field, how they pitched in the NL West. You know, we had everything, every split you could possibly look at. So, I mean, we had done all our homework, but at the end of the day, it comes down to finances. And we figured there's two or three on this list we're probably not going to be in competition for. But Zach was our number one target. We just didn't think it was realistic. And, you know, fortunately, we got in that game, and it worked out for us. But then as I mentioned, we didn't want to just have one, we wanted to have two. And, you know, knowing that Patrick Corbin was going to be, knock on wood, was going to be healthy this season, you know, now another year removed from his Tommy John surgery, the luxury of having him move to number three or even be a number two in between two right-handers was what really pushed us over the top to try and get that second piece.
Let's talk about that
second piece. Here we go.
Now, the Shelby Miller trade, far more controversial than the Greinke signing. Rightly so. Yes. Now, there had been talk about this deal with you guys for quite some time. Ultimately, you part with a pitching prospect, Aaron Blair, a good outfielder, Ender Inciarte, and last year's number one overall pick in the draft, the shortstop, Dansby Swanson. So I guess the question would be, at what point did you come to the realization that you would be willing to do that and trade the number one pick?
Ken, that was tough, obviously. And not just for Dansby, but you know, the way Ender played last year, you mentioned the other two. The way Inciarte played, he proved that he is a top of the batting order type guy, leadoff. You know, he hit 300 last year. He can play any of the three outfield positions. He's a spark plug. You know, he's energetic. He's fast. He's, you know, he can play great defense. That was tough. the fact that we needed starting pitching and we were going to move Aaron Blair, who will likely be in Atlanta's rotation, and he was ready to go, that was tough. But then you look at Dansby Swanson, who we had just obviously committed a great deal financially to in signing him. And he was a big part of why Hillsborough won, in our opinion, the championship last year. And he went in there and just gave them a boost of energy. It was a lot to give. But when we looked at who we could acquire, and we talked to every team, you know, and you can imagine who we went after when we talked to the White Sox and we talked to the A's and we talked to the Rays. I mean, you know, we were looking for that other top of the rotation type guy. Everybody wanted, I would say, much more than what we ended up parting with. And 29 teams wanted A.J. Pollock this offseason. Just like 3 years ago or 4 years ago, 29 teams wanted Paul Goldschmidt. And when we would hear Paul Goldschmidt, we'd hang up the phone. Same with A.J. And so in most of our discussions, they either wanted A.J. Pollock and or Patrick Corbin. And I get it. So when we started talking to the Braves, and they seemed like a better fit, In their model, what they were trying to do in the offseason, you could tell they were totally rebuild mode. The rumors were out there, obviously, on Shelby Miller. And Miller to us was a guy who, you know, power arm, number one or a number two in the rotation, perfect fit for us. But moving a guy like Dansby Swanson, you probably need your head examined because, you know, here's your number one pick, a shortstop, which is so tough to acquire. Yet that was a position of strength for us. We have so much depth when it comes to middle infield. And, you know, we look at our controversy this year and the competition we've already created this spring because of Nick Ahmed and even Brandon Drury, who's playing so well and can play second base. And now we bring in Gene Segura and you have Chris Owings. We've got depth there, and it's tough to part with a guy like that. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, they're going for it now. To a certain extent, yes. But we're a very young team. We were the youngest team in baseball last year. We're also going for the next 5 to 10 years.
Now, when I guess Dave Stewart first came to you and said, we might want to trade Swanson, what was your initial reaction?
He never said we might want to trade Swanson. You know, the Braves very wisely, you know, it came to him in when we inquired about Shelby and said it's going to take Swanson. And so that's when he came to me and said, if we're going to get him, it's going to take Swanson. And I went, ooh. And, you know, I think initially, and this was at the winter meetings, you know, when we were in Nashville. And I think initially we all said, nah, we can't do it. You know, we're looking at other names, and, you know, there's such a back and forth when it comes to these negotiations. And you're up in their suite, and they're up in your suite, and you're in their suite, and your phone calls. And ultimately, you know, when you look at the board and you're looking at who you have and what inventory you have and where you have depth, that played a big factor.
What was your evaluation of Swanson? Because the other day I asked Stewart about this, and he said, I think he'll be a good player. I'm not sure he'll be a great player.
I think he has a chance to be a great player. You know, he's performed at every level. You know, coming out of that draft, and I think there was controversy when we drafted him, when we picked him. People were thinking, why would you give this guy so much? And he wasn't a clear number one, and there really wasn't a clear number one that year. We felt strongly about Dansby Swanson. I mean, we think he's a championship-style player. And Tony, as you know, is really big into championship-style player. I can spot him. I can pick him. And Tony loves Dansby Swanson. I mean, loves the guy. And so he was our biggest hurdle when we decided to trade him, because Tony La Russa did not want to part ways with Dansby Swanson. And we think he's going to be a very good player. You know, when we look at him, he's going to hit, obviously. I think he's a plus defender. But the intangibles when it comes to Dansby are what put him over the top. He is an unbelievable kid. He's got, and this is, you know, this is what we all battle with. You know, when you look at the analytics and then you have to balance that with the personality. He's got what it takes. I mean, his personality is so strong. The kid is a winner. He's competitive. He's positive. He's, when you talk to Coach Corbin, Tim Corbin at Vanderbilt, and he's had some great ones. You know, he's had Sonny Gray and he's had David Price, and he'll tell you Dansby Swanson is the best player he's ever had when it comes to the mind and when it comes to being a leader. That tells you a lot. Vanderbilt is a powerhouse. And when Coach Corbin says, you got a great one, and we built a great relationship with Coach because of him, because of Dansby, and then when we traded him, it's, you know, we still fortunately have that relationship, but it was a bummer.
Now, before that trade...
But you have to give something to get
I am aware of that. Yeah. There was another controversial trade.
Oh, Ken, where are you going with this?
Tookie Toussaint. Now,
yes.
These are all interesting moves, and they're different moves than some other teams might make.
Right.
With Toussaint, you essentially sold a prospect, he was the prospect, for $10 million. You made another deal recently for Segura in which you kind of did a similar thing with Eason Diaz. Now, the question is, and it goes...
With Aaron Hill on that deal.
With Aaron Hill, yeah. And saving money.
Right.
Question is, then, Derek, with these deals, it almost seems like the Diamondbacks value prospects differently than the rest of the industry, where no one wants to trade a prospect ever. Is that the case? Would you say that's the case?
I wouldn't, and I get that. I mean, it certainly is the appearance. That's the perception. But I don't think so. When we challenge our baseball staff, we say, here is your budget. And, you know, and the baseball staff is pushing back to us saying, this is our window. We got to win. You know, we think we can win now for the next, you know, say 5 years. We're going to contend. We're going to compete. When you have Goldschmidt, when you have Pollock, when you have Corbin, we have to make moves. And for us, it's okay, but if you're going to make moves, you're going to have to create flexibility. And that's a big challenge for us rather than saying we're just going to spend wildly because we can't. We know we can't. We're in a market here that is not LA, it's not Chicago, it's not New York. So for us to challenge our baseball staff and say, create that flexibility with what you have, they're going to look at the big ticket items and say, how can we move them? And, you know, even Aaron Hill, would we have liked having Aaron Hill right here in spring training right now competing? Probably, you know, because he could play third, he could play second. He's a great guy in the clubhouse. But that was one that just jumped out and he said, wow, we could save that money. Let's go ahead and do it. Tookie Toussaint, you don't want to move Tookie, but if you have a pitcher who hasn't pitched and probably doesn't fit in your future plans and is making a fair amount of money, you're going to have to attach something with it. It is a unique model, and it's not something we're going to practice, you know, forever. It's not going to define us. We're not going to always look that way. But we had some contracts we had to relieve ourselves of in order to make the moves that we did this offseason. We created the flexibility so that we could build the roster the way we wanted to this year. I don't want to part with prospects, and I know they didn't either. They knew they were going to receive some criticism, and they have, and we deserve it. You know, as an organization, we deserve it. If you're going to move top prospects, that's two number one picks that we've moved. You know, that hurts, and we're an organization that does pride ourselves actually on prospects and on building from within. That's who we have to be. We have to scout properly. We got to draft properly. We have to develop from within. And for us to somewhat abandon that with a couple of moves that we made so that we could create that flexibility because we think we can win now, you know, that it, I don't want that to define us, but I understand why it could.
Now, you touched on this a little bit before. There's a misconception out there that you're built for just 2016.
Right.
That is not the case.
No.
In fact, I believe you have only one free agent on your roster, potential free agent, that's Ziegler.
Right.
How do you view the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, I think it's important that we keep this group together, and I think it's important that we continue to develop some of these young players that we have. We love what we have right now in the pipeline. I mean, you know, we have decisions this spring that are going to be interesting, they're going to be difficult, and it just shows how we're not going to have to go out and acquire, knock on wood, but we're not going to go out and have to acquire big free agents. When you have Socrates Brito, who's going to be pushing the envelope this spring to make this roster, I mentioned Brandon Drury, you know, the battle that he's going to have, you know, even at third base or second base this year, you know, Jake Lamb. We have such good young talent that I like where we're at. And it wasn't just for this year. And you mentioned it. I mean, Brad is the only free agent that we have after this season. I think the one position that we're often but where people are second-guessing us would be with relief. So, you know, when you're going to lose one of your best relievers, maybe we have to go out and do some things in the, you know, the next offseason. But, no, we're built now for, I would say, probably the next, as I mentioned, 5 to 10 years. We are a very, very young team. And in the moves that we've made, I think that the perception was that we gave up a lot of our young talent, and you could see that when you move two of your number one picks. But in actuality, we've acquired as many players as we have moved. The average age of those players that we've moved over the last year and a half is about 28, a little over 28. The average age of the players we've brought in is 22, a little over 22. So we're very young, and we're committed to it. And we've also signed, as you know, a number of international players who are young and ready to go, and or close to being ready to go. And it's our job to make them major league ready.
All right. It's an analytics crowd. Let's talk about analytics.
Okay.
It was just over a year ago, Dave Stewart was talking about James Shields, and he commented that he thought James Shields might want to come to the Diamondbacks because La Russa was there, and they were more of a true baseball team than a team that was more analytics-oriented. Yet, you guys have an analytics department, and it's not just Ed Lewis. It's beyond that. You're also, I don't know where you are with this, but you told me that you're building a proprietary database. So I guess what I would ask, Derek, where are you guys on the scouting analytics spectrum right now?
I think we're heavier than we've been in easily the last 5 years. You know, I think there was a time a couple regimes ago we may have been overly analytics, heavily analytics. Then we had a regime that I don't think used them enough. It's very important, you guys always hear it, that we have that balance. And I think now we have a very strong balance. I think we are as heavy as we've been in quite some time in analytics. And so we have a department now. We've got, you know, three full-timers that are working hard in analytics. We do have a database and a system that we continue to create. It's an important part of what we do. And I think the perception is always going to be that we don't care about analytics because, you know, Tony has made comments, but if you think about it, Tony was may have been the engineer of analytics, and Tony actually does value analytics. But all he says at the end of the day is he wants to make sure, gather all the information, provide us with all the information. But being a former manager, I don't want that to dictate how we're going to play the game. And so he has said to Chip, our manager now, Chip Hale, you know, do the same. I want your instincts to take over in a game. I want you to manage the game the way you want to. But it's great to have members of the staff that value those analytics. And we had Andy Green, who really embraced them. And you look at our defensive shifts last year and, you know, defensive runs saved. I think there were 72, 12 of those because of the shift. Is that good, Ed? And this year we're doing the same. In fact, I just saw our shifts the other day. It was perfect against the Padres. It was a ground ball that Kemp hit, and we were aligned perfectly. And that shows that Matt Williams now embraces it as well. But Chip Hale was someone who worked in the A's organization. He and Bob Melvin were over there. He was the bench coach to Bob Melvin. They obviously utilize analytics, embrace it. We do too. And so, you know, we've got every possible analytic that they could use and need. We've got guys working all day, you know, on the numbers and the spray charts and whatever they need, they've got. And it's every day in spring even. It's up to them then to utilize that to the best of their ability. And we're not going to dictate. And we don't want it to dictate, but we want it to play a factor.
Where is Chip on all this? Obviously, he gets the information each day. Is he someone who embraces it? Someone who is kind of, I don't know, in between? Where would you describe him?
I think Chip embraces it, but again, he's got Tony as a mentor. So, you know, he's hearing, don't just rely on that.
Right.
You know, so I think he's trying to go with gut, go with instinct, go with his own eye. And I'm fine with that, you know, as long as he knows that it's there. The other thing that Chip does very well is he'll tell his hitting coach, he'll tell his pitching coach, I want you guys to digest the information and use it how we need to. So he does, you know, in my opinion, he does a very good job of delegating that information and making sure that they're relying on it, and they are.
Just to clarify on Tony, so people understand, what Derek is talking about with the managing of the feel for the game, Tony has said he wants, as a manager, to have the ability to read a swing, to sense something that might be happening on the field, body language, could be 100 different things. And in his mind, what he is seeing, what he is processing, has more value, perhaps, than an individual number, or at least it factors into the equation. So it's not as if Tony is anti-analytics. In fact, if you read Men at Work by George Will, you see where it all began, kind of, and he was part of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he does have a very definite view on how they should be used.
Yeah, he does. But you know, Tony is, I think he would tell you he's old school. And, you know, he's very proud of his accomplishments and his success on the field. And he likes to think that, obviously, I mean, he's a smart guy, very smart guy. He's intelligent. He knows the game. In a lot of ways, he invented parts of the game. He's one of those managers that is such a strong personality. So I think it's difficult for anybody, be it him, be it, you know, Tommy Lasorda, be it, you know, anybody who had success as a manager to say, I won because of numbers or I won because of someone else. I can tell you, you know, he's come to me, if the numbers are put in front of him or the information's in front of him as it is today, he uses it. I mean, his guy will come to my office and go, hey, I know we're thinking about trading player X, and we're looking at this guy. Have you seen this guy's numbers on the road? You know, they're horrible. And, you know, I just kind of laugh. And I say, here's Tony looking at the numbers, you know. And every once in a while points him and go, what? You're looking at it? Well, yeah. I mean, it's here, of course. We can see. That's who he is. But, again, I mean, we're one of those teams that really believes in personality and character. I mean, I'm not going to dance around that. We care about personality and character. We like a certain type of player in our clubhouse. We care a lot about a person's past, about his behavior off the field. And, you know, that you don't always see in analytics. You know, we're going to talk to other teams' trainers, clubhouse guys, former teammates to find out what type of player it is. And that you don't always see in the numbers.
Now, obviously there was a story yesterday about Bryce Harper. Mm-hmm. Came out in ESPN, the magazine. I'm sure you at least are aware of it. And he said that the game is tired. He said there needs to be more personality. There needs to be more life. Guys need to show who they are. What do you think?
I'm a traditionalist. I believe in the unwritten rules in baseball. I really do. But it is, I mean, look, you're talking to the guy who agreed to change the colors and looks of uniforms, you know, so.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, okay, good. I believe in progressiveness and progression. We need to. And Harper is one of our bright young stars. Whether you like him or not, he's exciting. Kids like him. That's the most important thing, is that kids want to follow this guy. And I think there's value in what he had to say. And I don't think we should shun that or shut that out. I think, you know, players showing personality is important, and there's value to that. We have to create personalities in this game. We have to create personalities that kids and others want to follow and that they want to look up to. Now, it shouldn't be, you know, to the point of obscene gestures or anything lewd or crazy. But if you're going to bat flip, and by the way, look how much attention that got with Bautista. A lot of people, I think if we, you know, I think I said it yesterday on the radio, I think if we polled 10 people, 7 out of 10 would say, I thought that was pretty cool. I liked it. And it was the emotion and the moment. You know, it wasn't so much in your face. Is that a bad thing? Probably not for our sport. I want to promote our sport. I want people to like our sport. I want people to like our personalities and players. So if that's what it takes, and Bryce Harper is one of those future stars. He's a star now, but he's one of those big future stars. Let's listen to him a little bit, and let's not just blow him off or say he's wrong. I think it was great that he spoke up.
It's interesting, Derek. We had a question.
You disagree
yesterday.
With that?
No, I agree. In fact,
I think
the game would be in a better place if we saw a little bit more life from the players.
I agree.
And I know it's a fine line.
But it's policed by the veterans, too, who will say, hey, kid.
And it's a fine line. But you know what? It's also a different generation now. And I know the older guys go crazy with this stuff. But the way Bryce described it, he likes it when Jose Fernandez shows some emotion, even if it's at his expense.
I agree.
Fans, I'm not saying we should turn this into the WWE.
No,
but
me neither.
Fans would like this.
They would like that. And I got a guy working for me now who's in the Hall of Fame. He's our only Hall of Famer, big, tall, left-hander, the big unit. He had personality. And I was on the other side. I was with the Dodgers at the time when he was a Diamondback, and I couldn't stand the guy because, you know, he would strike three out and walk away, and he's cussing and screaming at the dugout. I'd go, God, why aren't we getting this guy? Let's, you know. And he did it, and I'm sure, you know, had we had the Internet or had we had social media 50 years ago, there were probably other players that were doing it as well. So, I mean, it's just, unfortunately, everything today is magnified. Everything is captured. Everything is distributed. Everything is magnified. I shouldn't even say unfortunately. That's a good thing. But it's different. You know, and because of that today, we shouldn't avoid it because you have a chance of being all over Twitter. I mean, if you're talked about, if you're followed, if you're liked, that's good for the game.
Which leads to another question. This came up yesterday. I thought it was really interesting. Someone in the audience asked, should a player's Q rating be factored into a team's decision-making on whether to acquire him? In other words, even if a player is maybe of modest skills or declining skills, but has this aura, whatever, about him.
Johnny Gomes.
Johnny Gomes is a good example, but I'm thinking more of a bigger star than Johnny. A guy who's popular who might help you sell tickets in some way, I don't know. How does that factor in? Does it factor in?
It does factor in a lot of markets. It actually doesn't in ours. You know, we tried. I mean, when we brought, well, let's talk about Randy again. When we brought him back the second time, you know, every fifth day, it wasn't as if you saw a lift in tickets or, you know, in sales. I mean, it just, some markets, it doesn't matter. I think it can help in the clubhouse, especially if you have a very young team. Bringing in somebody with a big personality, somebody who's been there, somebody who, you know, who is a veteran, that helps. You just have to think about the chemistry of your team. At the end of the day, you shouldn't be motivated by selling tickets. I mean, it's tough not to, especially in my position. But you have to make baseball decisions that are best for your roster and best for your team. And too many teams have made mistakes saying, let's bring this guy in, he's big, he can sell, and it doesn't fit. You know, we've got a clubhouse right now where it is a family, it's working. And we're going to have problems, we're going to have issues, of course, like anyone. But if we were to bring in an outsider that wouldn't fit because we think we could sell tickets, I think that's a big mistake.
Okay. Let's talk about your new uniforms.
Yes.
From what I can tell, you've got, I don't know, 23 different caps, jerseys.
That's not true.
You got the bloody sock pants that look pretty cool. Or some people don't think they look
right.
What goes behind the decision to make a uniform change, adjustment, and what is that process like?
A lot goes into that decision making. You know, we have wanted to make a splash when it comes to really with everything. I mean, I will challenge, I'll encourage our staff to be pioneering, be innovative, and to have other teams follow us all the time. We're looking for new, innovative ways to change the game. And we thought the uniform was another way that we could do that. And you know, you go back to, maybe it's a little bit of what Bryce Harper said. You know, we're tired. And if that's the case, how can we energize our you know, our sport? And I think the uniform is one way, because kids today are showing you they are gravitating, they're being pulled in, they're attracted to new-looking uniforms. I can remember, use Oregon as an example. When they first came out with their college football uniforms, I thought, are they crazy? Those are hideous. And a year later, I thought, man, are they smart? You know, and I couldn't wait to see the next one. And, you know, I think part of it, I'm a Pac-12 guy, and you know, was they were a rival of mine, so anything that they would do, I didn't necessarily, you know, want to like, but I love what they did. You see the NBA now does it, and it's working. Some other sports have done it. Baseball hadn't done it, hadn't taken that next step. We were in a position where we could. We could take that fashion-forward step because we're such a young franchise. I think it's very difficult, obviously, for the Yankees, for the Cubs, for the Dodgers, for the Tigers to make a move like that because their uniforms are so traditional and so unique. But for us to do it, you know, we had 9 years in the purple and teal. We now had 9 years in the Sedona red. We looked for a way to bring the two together. We brought back the old uniforms for Throwback Thursday, which is great because I love the old uniforms, and tried to figure out a way to put those in the rotation, get those in the rotation. So about a year and a half ago, we brought the players in and just asked them, you know, should we try something, and should we try it with you quietly, confidentially? And they said, let's do it. And really unique approach for us to bring in. You know, we brought in Goldie and AJ and Ciarte at the time, and Peralta and Tuffy Ghostwish. But we bring in all our players and our staff, and we had a whiteboard and said, clean slate. What have you seen that you like? How would you like our uniforms to look? And we started working on it. And it really was over a year that it never got out. Remarkable when you think we had Majestic working with us, who makes our uniform, New Era, who makes our caps, Nike, who does such good work with shoe wear, footwear, and batting gloves, etc. And they would send in some of the samples based on what our feedback was, and we'd open it up and go, that's not what we wanted. It doesn't look good. That looks good. We tried everything. We tried purple and red. It didn't really look good. Back 2011, when we hosted the All-Star Game, Major League Baseball took our logo, our colors, and they added light blue to it because they thought the blue sky with our Sedona red, trust us, is what we want to use. And we thought, we don't want any blue, but it looked terrific. And so that encouraged us to try another color, which was teal, our old color, with the red, and it looked really good. But our players got behind us. That was really the exciting thing, Ken. They were so into it. Our staff, you know, I mean, Chip was a part of it. His coaching staff was a part of it. To have players come in and try on the stuff that we brought, that we had sent to us as samples, and take pictures, and again, remarkable that it never got out. Unbelievable that it never got out. And they're excited. So there was total buy-in. We didn't use an outside agency. We did everything internally, in-house. And we knew we were going to take shots for it. You're going to take hits. We knew that. And, you know, when we, bottom of the end of the day, we knew at the bottom of the pants if we were going to have a pattern. I mean, we're going to get killed. You know, some of the things I was telling them is, okay, we're going to be called Pajama Pants, Spider-Man.
Whose idea was it?
I can't remember who.
That's the defining thing here. That's the thing that people are going to remember.
It's unique. And you know what? When we first, the first company that we went to with that was Nike and said, what do you think? And they said, we love it because we can bleed that into, you know, a shoe. And, you know, and that's just one shoe. Some guys wear Under Armour, some whatever. It's not all Nike. But the great thing was all the vendors. New Era, Majestic, Nike, they were so ecstatic that we were doing this. Major League Baseball was excited. I worried about Major League Baseball, you know, telling us, no way. You know, and Rob Manfred, credit to him, but he looked at it. He sent me an email and said, I just saw the samples online. Because we emailed them to him. He said, they look great, congratulations, we needed to do this. So that, it's been for the most part, well-received, but you're going to get criticized for it. But I think at the end of the day, others are going to do it. This gray uniform, Majestic said, they've had at least half the teams already call and ask for the exact color that we're using because their players and fans have said we like that. And we went with a real dark gray this year that I think is going to be sharp on the road. We can't keep the jerseys in stock at our team shop, so it's exciting. I mean, they're flying off the shelf.
Great.
And the favorites have been that combination of the red and the teal. My favorite is the white with the red, Sedona red and the teal in the background. But the one that's selling like crazy, and you never see this with a team, is our road uniform, our Arizona that has the teal and the red. That's our most popular uniform, and Majestic says road uniforms never sell for a team. And they're just shocked at how many road uniforms we're selling because it does look good.
Funny story. The day after, I believe, those uniforms came out, we had Derek on MLB Network.
It was the same day.
Was it the same day?
That was the Friday.
Okay. Well, he's going on and on just like he went on.
That was the Friday that we signed Greinke. I'm on
okay.
with him.
Yeah, this was early.
I'm at the ballpark, on their ballpark camp.
Right.
Yeah.
So eventually,
my buddy Ken.
Eventually, Derek finishes. I'm like, Derek, okay. What are you going to do with all this money that you're getting from these uniforms? And then... they came up with an answer.
And to Ken's credit, when I saw him at Nashville, he said, okay, I need to apologize. You really did. You really did spend some of that money.
Hey, you spoke about innovative things and always trying to be on the cutting edge. One thing that we also talked about a little bit yesterday, the medical side. And teams trying to find a way or ways to keep their players on the field, to prevent injuries, prehab, however you want to call it. What are you guys doing? How serious a matter is this?
It's a very serious matter. And I think what works now today is the communication between teams. I think we've all figured out that we compete on the field, but we don't compete off the field. And we finally have gotten to a place where best practices are shared. And we've got as advanced a medical staff as there is. Ken Crenshaw, our head athletic trainer, is probably the most respected in all of baseball. I think, you know, I'm biased, but I think he's the best there is. So he's always got their health in mind, and so he's got a system. I would need him to explain it to you, but he's got a system that shows you, even projects when players are going to break down. And so it plays a factor. I don't think most teams it does. It's an analytical factor when it comes to medicine of whether we should sign a guy, whether we should extend a guy. And they will tell you based on how well, how hard they work, their medical conditions, their rehab, their body, the x-rays, everything, MRIs, whether a guy's going to break down, and he can almost pinpoint when it's going to be. So they're terrific. And, you know, I think it's an important factor now for us as an organization, but my point was we all share a lot of our best practices now with other teams. So I don't think that we're so advanced over any other team. I mean, we all know what other teams are doing, and when you get a player who comes over and says, hey, something that was working in Boston, I may want to do here, and others do. But the difference for us, we have a medical staff that's here year-round at Salt River Fields, and so our players can be with us year-round. Take Yasmani Tomas. You know, obviously we were concerned with his conditioning, and we kept him here all season or all off-season, and we worked with him. And so our medical staff was with him constantly. We have an advantage with Salt River Fields here where we can rehab players here, we can watch our players all year long, we can watch their nutrition, we can shape their nutrition and their workout, their strength and conditioning, because it's a year-round operation at Salt River Fields.
So really, it's happening that the team like the Dodgers, one of your biggest rivals, your biggest rival, they would share medical practices with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's...
Teams are always looking for an edge now, any edge they can get. It seems hard to believe that that would actually happen.
They do. They really do. And we do as well. I mean, as presidents, when we get together at owners' meetings, we're sharing best practices when it comes to ticket sales and when it comes to pricing. I mean, you have to. I mean, take advantage of the relationships you have. And although we're rivals, you know, Larry Bear and I talk constantly, and we're friends. You know, my best friend in baseball was Kelly McGregor, who unfortunately passed away. But he and I would call each other all the time and share, hey, I'm having trouble here. What's worked for you? We have to have that. I mean, there's only 30 of us. And so we have to rely on each other. Now, I've got better relationships with some markets than I do others. And I just know, you know, who to go to. I could give you five guys that would be my go-to guys. And I'm sure everybody would tell you the same thing. It's not that I go to all 29.
Right.
But yeah, they share. And just like the trainers, they all have to share too. And if they don't, they're crazy. You know, I encourage our trainer, go find out what others are doing, what's working, what's not working. And you're only as good, unfortunately, as your specialist that you bring in, as your orthopedic doctor, as your, you know, dermatologist, as your general doctor. I mean, you have to have a strong team around you, and you can't be afraid to make changes, and we have. You know, even mid-season if you need to, because mistakes have been made. Every team will tell you mistakes are made, and, you know, misdiagnoses are there as well. But you're only going to be as good as you are healthy. And that's for us this year. You know, we made a lot of changes. We know we have to be healthy. We have to be lucky. And we haven't won a thing yet.
Hey, I was reading last night your Wikipedia page, sorry. And I was not aware of this, but I guess Yahoo named the Diamondbacks the best workplace in sports. When was that? Was it this year, last year?
A couple years.
A couple years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure it hasn't changed dramatically.
No, we still are.
All right. So how do you develop that? What makes the Diamondbacks that good?
It's a really strong culture, and it's a unique place to work, and everybody loves to work there. And you know, it's tough. We're in a tough industry, and some of you want to be in our industry, and it's, you know, you're talking 15-hour days. I mean, Ken knows this, and you know, you get in at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning during a homestand, and you don't leave till midnight after the game that day, and you get up the next day and do the same thing. And during a difficult season, challenging season, when you're losing, and you have to come in every day with a smile on your face, and you still have to open those gates and hopefully fill your seats, it's tough. So we wanted to make sure that our organization is about family, and that everybody loves coming into work each and every day, that they wear that logo with pride. And by the way, this is not how we dress. I'm going to a funeral after this. You know, I don't usually wear a suit. I used to. So when I first came here, this will tell you, you know, the interaction with our fans is very important. It's unique here. Our players get it. They interact with our fans better than any team in sports. They sign autographs, mandatory. They take pictures. I mean, you know, Nick will tell you at spring training it happens, you know, each and every day. It's rare and unique, but it's who we are. So I'm wearing my suit when I first came to work for the D-backs, and I'm at a game, and this woman comes up to me, and she said, Mr. Hall, can I tell you something? I said, sure. She said, you look like an idiot. I said, excuse me? She said, it's 110 degrees outside. This is baseball. You ask us to buy this stuff, and you don't even wear it? I said, yeah, good point. And so we all wear the logo each and every day, but we want everybody to enjoy wearing it. And it's just, it's an awesome place to work. It is family. There's no silos, no hierarchies. It is truly a team. We have 350 full-time employees that love coming to work there. And if they don't, you know, they won't fit. And it's a place of innovation. You know, you come into our front office, it's not the front office. You'll see it's the Culture and Innovation Center. That's what it is. And we're all about culture. We're all about making sure that everybody's enjoying their work there, and that we help each other, that we pick each other up. And It's unique, Ken, and even with our team, it's not us and them. It's not the suits, and it's not us. I mean, the players feel like a part of the family. They come to our holiday party, you know, evening on the diamond. They're all there, our big fundraiser. All of our employees are there. It's a close-knit group, and that's the way I want it.
Last question, then we'll open it up for a few.
Okay.
What would make for a successful season? Does it have to be a playoff appearance? World Series appearance?
That's a great question. And, you know, I honestly have not been asked that. For me, I think making the playoffs is a successful season, but I feel that way every year. I go into each season personally thinking we're going to finish dead last. You know, that's got to be my mindset, so how are we going to overcome that? How are we still going to draw? And when that does happen, it's very painful. And we've had, you know, good seasons, bad seasons, but you think about the success we've had in this market in a short amount of time, the divisions that we've won, the World Series that we won. It's a market that is used to winning, and it's a market that expects you to win, and if you are winning, they'll show up. So we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to do exactly that. I think we saw a huge improvement last year, 15-game swing. We need to contend. We'll be a successful season, Ken, if we are in the final week of the season right in the thick of it. And, you know, it's going to be a tough division, as you guys know. The Giants, Dodgers, ourselves, but don't count out the Padres. The Padres last year were everybody's pick. They made a few changes since, but maybe they've improved. The Rockies, that's a tough place to play. Anytime you go there, they've got a great offensive team. Our division, we're going to beat each other up. What scares me is I think it's going to be difficult for a wild card team to come out of the West because we're all going to beat each other up all season.
Okay, fair enough. Any questions? Go ahead, bud.
As a physician,
tanking?
Yeah.
No, I would hope not. I don't think it's a sustainable model. No, I do not. And I think that there's corrective measures. We're seeing that to avoid it. You know, and I think baseball's obviously got its finger on the pulse, and we can tell when it's occurring, and we try and correct it as soon as we can. But I think, you know, we're such a competitive industry, and I interact with all of the owners and all the presidents, and I don't see a lot of it. I really don't. So to answer your question, no, I don't think it's going to sustain or can be sustainable. And I think it's wrong, but I think we're watching each other.
Do you think it's
sure
happening? Are teams tanking?
I think it has happened. I don't think it's happening. I really don't. I mean, I can tell you, you know, you would even think going into the offseason, okay, this team is going to move their ace for sure because they know they don't have a chance. Then they turn right around, they sign a free agent, and you're probably thinking the same team I am, and you think, no, they think they can win. And now some people are picking them to win. It's happening throughout the industry because everybody thinks they have a chance to win. There's a lot more parity today than there ever has been, and I think there could be even more after the next CBA because, you know, we're trying to make this game as level and fair as can be, but everybody's got to compete. And I think the other 29 owners, I know our owner wants to win. You know he does. He's uber competitive, and I think the others are too. I can't see a team tanking anymore.
You know what, I should ask you about the CBA. I know it's a $9.5 billion industry. There's plenty of money for everyone. At the same time, there's a new head of the union. There's a new commissioner, though he, of course, has been involved in labor negotiations. I'm a little concerned, personally, about this next negotiation. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I'm concerned, too, and it's been a record amount of length of labor peace. You know, but I give a lot of the credit of that to Rob Manfred, who's now our commissioner. I think we've learned in the past that any time off is bad for the game. So, you know, I'm confident. Of course, I'm worried anytime we're going into negotiations, but I'm confident that both sides realize how important it is for us to come together on all the issues, and I think we will. When you have a first-time head of the union and a first-time commissioner and they're both digging in, that's the, you know, obviously that's the concern, but they're both smart, level-headed, and We've all done so much work leading into it. There's going to be no surprises. Okay. That's most important.
There you go.
As somebody who wants the team as a whole to be as successful as possible without small breaks along the way, what do you think about getting baseball back in the Olympics?
That's a great question. Baseball back in the Olympics. And I've been in the middle of that debate. You know, I'm on the international committee for the MLB owners, and so we talk about the WBC. We created the World Baseball Classic because we're no longer in the Olympics. We want to have that international showcase. You know, I worked for Peter O'Malley, who was such an ambassador of the game, and he always had a true vision of a World Series, a real World Series. So we call it the World Series, but it's really the North American Series. And so he always wanted to have a true World Series, and I would too one day. I love the Olympics. I think it's a great place to showcase that. The problem is the timing. It really is tough for us. I mean, it's right in the middle of our season, and to ask players to stop, break, and go play, it's unrealistic, even for our minor leaguers. You know, it's tough for us to do that. I'm a big fan, as I mentioned, of the Olympics, and I always liked baseball in the Olympics. You have professionals or amateurs, that's the big debate. I just don't think you can have major leaguers right now in the Olympics. It doesn't make sense with our season. Sure, yeah. You know, we have to be universal for sure. I mean, you talk about a Diamondback way when it comes to player preparation, and it's not just the way you play on the field, but it's also how you carry yourself off the field. We are extremely committed to the community. You know, we've surpassed $45 million in community giving just this past year in our short time frame. We want the same to happen with our players down in the minor leagues. So they are spending time at schools and hospitals and signing autographs so that when they come up here, it's this, you know, it's what is expected. Same with our medical approach. We want to make sure that all of our trainers and all of our strength and conditioning coaches are following the same guidelines as our major league staff so that at every level it trickles down, it's the same. So when you go from single A to double A, your treatment's not going to be any different. It's going to be the same. Your workload is going to be the same. The expectations of how you prepare are going to be the same. They're doing it in spring training. It carries on from there into our affiliates, and we have to make sure that we continue to make sure that it is a universal approach. So it's got to be the same organization.
Those guys are eating Wendy's every day, though.
A lot of them do. Yeah, but they
can't get
can.
The same spread that
they can.
Major leaguers get.
I know. Well, and that's
I mean, seriously, that's
a big focus, Ken, and there's debate there too. You know, or should we just have nutritional food? You know, I mean, there's a debate. Yet, I'll tell you can ask Gonzo, who works for me, and he'll say, "I don't want any of that. You know, I don't want just turkey. I want steak after a game. And you know, I'm shedding off calories, and I need to make sure I eat." And you talk to other players, and they'll say, "Hey, I just want fish, and I want grilled. I don't want anything fried." So you just make sure you provide both. But I think we've really cleaned up our act. I mean, you walk through and you see our spread now, and it's a lot more healthy than it used to be. And that's because of the philosophy of our trainers. And you know, we owe it to ourselves. But there's so many tests nowadays. I think in the past, you know, you show up to Vero Beach, Florida on the first day and you have a physical and you know you're checking your reflexes. You know, today, you know, you go in the first day and you're checking your cholesterol, you're looking at blood pressure, EKG, the whole deal, and then you're gonna do it periodically throughout the year to make sure that there aren't fluctuations, you're still healthy. So I mean we've got our minds in the right place. We are focused on health and nutrition.
All right, let's get one more right there.
Me personally on DH, it's funny where the commissioner came down because he took a really firm position on it, and I applaud it, and it's one that I have because I understand why we have the DH. I understand why we really can't take the DH away. I mean, you can't because if you're the union, you can't go for that. I mean, this creates longevity. It increases salaries. It gives people positions for, you know, who are too old to play in the field or who are just offensive players who have a job in the AL. So I get it. I'm adamantly opposed to having the DH in the NL. And then again, I told you I'm a traditionalist. You know, I grew up an NL fan. I grew up a Dodger fan. I worked for the Dodgers for years. Now I'm over here. I love the strategy of the game with a pitcher in the batting order. I love it. You know, I love the fact that you can pitch around the eight-hole hitter to get to the pitcher for your third out, moving guys over with your pitcher. Love it. You know, I do know the risks because you are exposing your pitcher to injury, and you know, he could certainly get hit or he could break a hand trying to lay down a bunt or what have you. But I think it's such a beautiful thing, the strategy of having the pitcher in the batting order. I agree with the commissioner, and I'm glad he came out and said it. It's unique to baseball. He likes that it is one way in one league, one way in the other league. But what I think, when it comes to interleague play, and I applaud Bud for bringing interleague play into the fold, but the reason why we brought it in the fold was so that teams could see, or fans could see teams that they ordinarily wouldn't see. So if that's the case, let's show them a style of game they ordinarily wouldn't see. And when the AL teams come into an NL park, let's use the DH. When we go over and play in the AL, let's make the pitcher hit. If you're really going to do it for that reason, let's practice it for sure.
It seems obvious.
Yeah.
Derek, thanks very much.
Thank you, Ken.
Appreciate
Thank
the time.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Great.
Thanks.